ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Webb, the science editor at ABC RN. For the last 4 weeks, you've heard a remarkable series of Boyer lectures from Professor Michelle Simmons, a scientific trailblazer in the field of quantum computing. Following the TV recording of her first lecture, Professor Simmons wanted to hear from the audience. These are the questions and answers that followed. We can all breathe out now.
There we go. Sigh of relief.
The lecture is recorded, and now we have a rare opportunity to sit in a room and ask questions of Professor Michelle Simmons. I mean, I've got so many, I could just...
You're going to have to warm us up.
Pick your brains all night. You make it sound like Australia's in a very fortunate position and like this is all going to happen alarmingly quickly, but I know there's still a lot to be worked out, and everyone else is working on this as well, right? Huge investments in Europe, big tech in the US, China's probably working on it very hard as well. How long do you really think we have to wait, and what do you need for Australia to be the one that succeeds and gets there first? Because there's such huge investment happening right around the world.
There is, and I think people get quite nervous about the fact that they hear lots of stories in the media about the investment everywhere else. And I think one of the things people forget is that Australia got into this field in 2000. And so we've been working on it for more than two decades, so three centres of excellence worth of funding. If you total it up, our centre of excellence have raised about $450 million already. The company's raised $130 million. And so if you look at that investment, and that's without the infrastructure that's gone behind it from the Australian Research Council and from universities, the amount of investment in Australian teams, in particular in the Silicon area, has been quite extraordinary. And that's put us in a commanding position, I think, now to translate to make companies here in Australia. And so if you look even now, if you look at the kind of German investment, that's come in the last few years, and they're really playing catch-up. And so one of the things I think is quite important that I would love to get across to governments and industry in Australia is that we got in early, we've patented along the way, we've built this amazing workforce, six centres of excellence have quantum at the core, and so it really is a position for us to grasp it, you know, the bull by the horns, and to make it happen. And I think one of the things I've learned in the last 5 years or so is that whilst Australia is fabulous at supporting research and doing strong collaborations at the early, what we call technical readiness levels, when it gets to commercialization, there's a hesitancy and it's almost a lack of confidence to be able to take it the whole way, despite all the great things that are here that should make you just do it.
You make a good case. And there are, even just here in Sydney, right, there's at least two more teams working at a really global sort of competitive level. Does it feel like a competition or does the rising tide lift all the boats?
It's definitely the rising tide. So I think when we started, if you look at what's happened in Australia, we had 2007 Quintessence Labs was a secure communications company out of ANU. They were the first. And, you know, if you think about how long they've survived, really in what some people might say is the early stages of quantum, they've done incredibly well. I think we kind of came along in 2017. Since that time, we've spun out Dirac, which is another company in the University of New South Wales, which is also in Silicon. But there's been Acacia, there's Q Control. So there's just this plethora of companies coming out of Australia. And it's definitely the case. And I think this is, again, something Australia has to recognise. When you have lots of companies, it's good for every company that all the other companies exist. So it's definitely the rising tide. And I think it would be great if other, you know, across the nation, we could celebrate everyone in the quantum space because it is such a phenomenal story. And if you look outwards from Australia, everybody knows Australia is in a good position.
So we have the question in the front row first.
Thank you for such an excellent presentation. I would just like to check on what you have actually asked, but how far away are you from the actual getting it to market?
That's a great question. And so one of the things I've tried to do is look at, you know, follow this silicon route from the classical computing, and that really gives a roadmap in time from what they did from the 1940s. So it took about 10 years to go from a first transistor to an integrated circuit and another 5 years before they had a commercial product. We have just done our first integrated circuit essentially last year. So we're within 5 years, I think, of having a product. But then if you look at the computing industry, it's a 70-year industry. So it gets better every year. So we are at the beginning of that 70-year industry. So I think in the next 5 years, you'll see some products coming out. They won't be the fully programmable computer. That will probably be at least another 10 years away. But I think we're talking 5 to 10 years.
Can I just ask another question in relation to the chips that you're using? What's the sensitivity with Taiwan?
So Taiwan has, I think it owns about two-thirds of the world's production of silicon chips for the classical industry. And so they are kind of the world leaders. I think it's a fascinating story for everyone in the world to learn about. So the US used to be the leaders in the semiconductor industry, but then they found that basically it was cheaper to send it across to Asia. And so Taiwan, recognizing this, trained a huge number of people. And they actually, right at the school level, made them realize that learning engineering subjects was critical for the future of their country. So they trained people from school to take over this industry. And then the US lost the lead. So it all went to Taiwan, which is why they're in such a strong position. And so you will hear now about something called the CHIPS Act. It's the US realizing they've lost the lead. They want to gain it back. But all of that, for me, is old news. And so I'm looking at quantum and I'm looking at what's the future. And my honest belief is that you need to have that precision to make things at the quantum level. And I think Australia is the only company that can manufacture silicon quantum computing, the only company that can manufacture with atomic precision. So I think we are the foundries of the future. If we want to control the atomic world, we need that precision.
There was a question at the front of the grandstand.
Hi, Michelle. Annabelle Astbury. I'm the head of education at the ABC.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for your lecture. Michelle, how are we preparing young people, not only in Australia but around the world, to be engaged and excited about this quantum future or present?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. I think as this field is taking off, and it literally is taking off exponentially, everyone realises there's a lack of people globally. That's why Australia is in such a good position, because we've had these centres for a long time. But we've recognised that really you've got to start getting people from, you know, almost high school level through their university degrees to come into those companies. So for me, the exciting thing we've done is set the company up inside the university. And we're now looking, we bring school children through every year so they can see what's going on. But we're also looking at hiring people from the first year of their undergraduate degree to come and see what we're actually doing. And I think it's been quite exciting to see them come in and they're having a lecture in something and then they come to our labs and they actually use it in the same week. And that's kind of a utopic view about how you break down the barriers between companies and universities. And again, it's something Australia can do. I mean, it's very hard to do this in the US. If you set up a company in the US, they literally force you out of the university and you're cut off, like the umbilical cord is cut. And so I think Australia has the ability to grow these companies in universities and to bring people through the whole time.
And Justin up the back.
Hi there. My name's Justin. I work in ABC News. That was a fantastic lecture. Thank you. I'm just wondering, how will we use these computers and what are the practical impacts they'll have on our day-to-day lives?
That's a good question. That's in my second lecture. So I knew anyone that was coming tonight was going to be disappointed because I didn't say that. So look, I think one of the things that I've also looked at, and this is just, again, comparing to classical. When classical computing came along, we made hardware, but we didn't know what we were going to do with it. So we knew kind of the ones and zeros of the mechanical calculating machines, but we made them and we were making hearing aids and transistors and radios, transistor radios. With quantum computing, it's different. Because people have seen the classical industry, there's a whole bunch of algorithm people looking at the applications. And so now we've got this really bizarre situation where there are, you know, hundreds of applications, but there's no hardware to run it. And so that's really where we're at. So the pull is massive. So those application areas, it goes across anything with large amounts of data. So the kind of one that kicked it off was cryptography, so being able to break codes. Search engine optimization, so fast database searching is another one. But then you start to look at quantum mechanical calculations, so looking at chemistry. And so the things that we see kind of nearer term are things like figuring out how to make more efficient fertilizer. And so this is something, again, it's kind of weird. If now we're in the field, we've heard about this for a while, but you know, to break up nitrogen, it's a triple bonded molecule. It's very hard. To break that costs a lot of energy. And it takes about 1% to 2% of the world's energy to break that nitrogen triple bond. And it produces 3% of the world's carbon CO2 production. And so with a quantum computer, you can try and find a catalyst that can help break that triple bond. And it's a quantum chemical calculation, that the kind of thing that quantum computers should be really good at. So that's one kind of really tangible near-term thing that everyone's very excited about quantum computing solving. But then it starts to look at things like drug design. So at the moment, when you have a drug and you try and get it through trials, it takes about 10 years. It's a process, again, that takes a lot of money and it has a high failure rate. But again, if you look at the drug designs, you're really looking at the kind of chemistry of how the drug interacts with the human body. And those are the kind of thing that quantum chemical calculations using a quantum computer should be able to do pretty well. So those are some early examples, but there are now tens and tens of applications all waiting for the hardware.
I'm going to ask a quick follow-up and then we'll go to Darren up the back. I can't help myself. Everyone's talking about AI because it's 2023,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And you didn't mention AI once when you talked about the potential applications. So the ones that everyone's excited about use neural networks, which basically get smarter by learning on lots and lots of data.
Yes.
Will quantum computing make any difference there? Because neural network systems are already predicting what structure a protein will have based on its sequence. And
that's right. Like that. So I know this is a field that you're passionate about. So, but no, it's true. So when I have to admit, 5 years ago, I didn't think there was going to be any overlap. But now I'm seeing quantum and AI really start to come together. So there's quantum machine learning. It's a new field. There are lots of technical aspects that have to be solved to make that work. You've got to create quantum memories. But yes, everyone's very excited about the combination of those two fields. And even to the point where we're building processes and we're using AI to now help build our processes. We're using AI to help optimize how we run our processes. So those two fields, I think, are going to like supercharge each other.
Quantum memory sounds like a good title for a novel. Darren, up the back.
Thanks, Jonathan. And Justin and Jonathan both sort of preempted my question, but it leads to an obvious next question. With different forms of computing, does that imply we're going to need new forms of algorithms, new forms of software to run that kind of computing?
Yes. Yeah, it's happening already. So I think one of the exciting things that I've had with the companies. When we started the company, we were literally going to build the hardware chip at the bottom. And we thought that, you know, other people would then help build the rest of the computer in the way that kind of it happens in the classical world. But then we realized that in order to get the information in and off that chip, we have to use FPGAs, so high frequency control of the information. So then we brought in people that are experts in this audience who I think are fantastic and they know that, that started learning how to get information in and off the chip very quickly. Then we realized actually we have to program that. So we need a kind of layer of control programming. And again, we bring in software engineers that do that. Before we knew it, we're going up to the architecture designs. And then we need people that were actually programming the software, the quantum computer, and then the algorithm people. Suddenly, what started as this little tiny thing at the bottom, no joke, with the atoms, is suddenly now all the way through the whole stack of the company. And yes, you need people that understand how all of that works. And I think, you know, just again, to the plug for the company, we're competing with other companies globally. And very few of them will have that full stack team. And to get a full stack team, you've got to have expertise at every layer where they can all talk to each other in a way that they're all focused on one mission. And so, again, I think Australia's got an incredible competitive advantage to be able to do that. We're highly collaborative. We've got the skills in every layer, and we can do it here. So it's a very exciting time for Australia, which is why I'm really keen, not just for our company, for all quantum companies to recognise we have what we need here.
Who else? There's another one up the back.
Hi, I'm Damien. I'm interested in the second-order effects of technologies like this. You're describing, I guess, a finite number of devices that will probably be quite expensive to own and operate. But also, you mentioned earlier cryptography. Much of the modern world runs on cryptography, and this type of technology effectively renders that technology obsolete. So I'm interested in sort of the ethical and sort of social considerations around the introduction of a technology like this, that, you know, are we looking at a stratification of access and what are the implications for that? Because concerns around privacy, commerce, the way nation states share information, all of that has potentially, you know, profound implications with the introduction of a technology like this.
Yeah, look, I think that's very true. So if you look at what's happening with AI now, obviously, you know, people talk about the horses bolted. In the quantum field, I think right at the beginning we recognised this technology was powerful to the extent that we getting the government as a shareholder into the company was a deliberate move so that it wasn't in the hands of academics, you know, so that the government knew what was happening. So we briefed them and defence constantly about the speed of which the technology is changing. But I think even now, if you look at what the government's doing, it's got lots of different programs coming out in national strategy for quantum. It's embedded in that national strategy, looking at the ethics from the get-go. And so there's kind of two sides to this. From my perspective as a person developing the hardware technology, you know, I can see the speed at which it's going. So I know that breaking Shor's algorithm is at least another decade away, but I can start to give them a sense of when it's going to come. And they're building those policies now into the whole strategy as we go. So it's quantum's in a better place than AI. But yeah, it's got to happen in tandem.
It was a more personal question. So you talk a lot about the importance of diversity in the scientific workforce, gender balance in particular. And I think in one of the future lectures you talk about just how outnumbered you were when you started, and you're slightly less outnumbered now. Do you know, we always hear that you can't be it if you can't see it, but you are now extremely visible, extremely successful as a you know, a woman quantum computational engineer, quantum physicist.
Yeah.
Does that change things? Do you see a difference in the applications or the interest that you get for working in your company or your lab compared to other labs?
Look, I do. I do see there's more interest, and I think we've been focusing a lot on primary and secondary school to get them in at that level. And if you look at where the numbers drop, it's typically around about the age of 14 to 16. That's where the first dip happens. But then even if females get into the field, it tends to just gradually decrease as they get more and more senior. And so I don't honestly know why that happens. I wish I did, because I would try and stop it. But if you look at it, the 14 to 16-year-olds, I think girls are looking at, what's my career going to be? What am I going to do? And in general, with physics, physicists are everywhere, and so there's no one kind of career. It's not like you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. So it's very hard to describe what a physicist is going to be, except that they can have any job. And so that doesn't normally make young females feel, oh, that's good, I'll do it then. And so there's an education in that. I think seeing female role models is actually quite important. And so if you look again, we at one point we took a photograph of our Centre of Excellence, and there were 22 professors in it, and there was only one female in the photo. And we were going to put it on the website, and that's like, you know, it's not an attractive thing for young girls to want to join that team. Yeah. And so there's lots of things that we have to be careful of with the signalling that goes out. I think in general, females don't like being up in the spotlight, so it's not something I'm very comfortable with. But I've learned that it's absolutely critical that I do this as much as possible so that girls can see it and not just see who I am, but hopefully see how much I love what I do and how much fun I have, because it is an amazing field. I mean, honestly, it's the most rewarding thing. And so I just feel about all these females missing out on all of this. So,
well said. Susan.
I'm Michelle Sissonpont. Great lecture as usual. Back to the hardware. In 70 years' time, when your first computer is in a museum, what's it going to look like, and under what conditions will it have operated? And then what do you think will have replaced it?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, so the funny thing about this is, believe it or not, we've got museums asking for our systems already. So our single-atom transistor, there's two museums fighting for that at the moment, and our first atomic manipulation, huge STM MBE system people are trying to get. So anyway, but so the computer itself at the moment is in a cryostat. So it looks a bit like a human. It's got lots of cables going in it, and it's kept at low temperature and a high magnetic field. But if you look at the cryostats that we use today, they are already very different from the cryostats that we used 5-10 years ago. So that technology is rapidly changing. And honestly, they are the people that are making money out of quantum computing, the people that make the cryostats. I think the whole idea, though, when we make this industry at the beginning, is that it's going to be accessed via the cloud. And so we have what we call a server farm. We've got 10 bays with 10 different dilution fridges that we're going to bring in so that people can then access it over the internet. So that will be the first thing. I don't know what it's going to look like in 10, 20 years' time, but I already know in my mind how dramatically I want to change the way we organise our lab to be the next lab. So I can see how we operate now, and I can see how better to operate it in the future. And I'm super keen to move to that next level because I think it will make us go faster. So, but yeah, things are changing so rapidly that I'm a very much in the moment person. I love looking back, I love looking forwards, but I'm really focused on the now.
Robin.
Thank you, Jonathan. By the way, in the old days, of course, the computers were actually women. It was only later that became hardware.
That's
but
true.
I want to ask you a question about what it might look like from the outside. In other words, talking about the quantum computer, the science thereof, often it's depicted as a sort of race with only one winner, a horse called Silicon, bred by Michelle. And on the other hand, they're good competitors, but eventually there's one winner. It's a bit as if there was Howard Florey and only one antibiotic, which is penicillin. Some of us, of course, see it in a different way, that there are lots of people in the race and most of them can be winners, which is an exciting thing, and they will change the world if they know what kind of world they want to make. So which view do you see?
Look, I think at the moment the race is the first to show that you can actually get a quantum computer that outperforms a classical computer. And so, you know, at the end of the day, there's all the different approaches about how you get there. nobody honestly knows which one's going to win. So that's the situation. And so whenever people are in a race, they're obviously going to be trying to go as fast as they can. But all of us know intrinsically that everyone's success helps everybody else. And so, you know, we've got people that are working with photons of light. They have unique ways of encoding information. We've got people using ion traps. Everyone that's making those systems are developing technologies that's useful for their system that we all benefit from. And so one of the exciting things I've seen happen for me in the last couple of years is the superconducting community, which is really the US has kind of led that field, has now started working closer with the semiconducting community. And so the things that they've been using to make their systems work, we are now importing to our systems. And the materials understanding from our system, they're importing to theirs. And so I think, you know, in science, that happens all the time. It naturally happens. But the competition, I think for me, it shouldn't be seen as a negative. It's just life, you know. People want to get there, want to make things, and it's to be celebrated. So competition, collaboration, Australians are excellent at both.
It seems to me, Michelle, that as much as the applications, which are often the first thing that we all ask about, you know, what's going to change first? How fast is my iPhone going to be? It seems to me that you are just as much driven by the curiosity and the wonder, looking at that logo made from individual atoms and going, I want to make stuff out of individual atoms and do computations on electrons and phosphorus nuclei.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. So for me, you know, I'm fundamentally curious about Do humans have the ability to control something that we can't see and to get it to do things that we theoretically think could make computing exponentially faster? And so it's this beautiful, you know, put out a big problem out there, and it requires us every technology that we have, all the understanding we have in the world to try and make it, and then get all those different expertises together to see, can we control nature at that level? I just think it's fabulous. And, you know, Richard Feynman, I think if you go back, he wrote this lecture, Controlling the World of Atoms, and he kind of said there's no reason why we couldn't do it. And he did that in the 1950s when we couldn't even see atoms. And so he already said there's no reason why we can't do it. There's no reason why we can't make things at that length scale. And so for now, I'd love to sit and have a beer with him and just, you know, yes, we've done it, but then what can we do with it? You know, there's these computers, if we can get it all working, and it would be great just to brainstorm. So, yeah, we're seeing things that, you know, in his time he would have hoped to have seen, and now we're seeing it. It's pretty exciting. I mean, you can't beat that, really.
I was nodding because I was reading, I think, your third lecture where you talk about Feynman's lecture today. Yeah. Also features a description of another very significant photo, which also only had one woman in it, but you should all listen to the third lecture to find out the details about that one. Jane.
Thank you. In one of Jonathan's earlier questions, he mentioned AI as one of the obsessions of 2023, but the other one is climate change. And in one of your earlier answers, you mentioned in passing that question of nitrogen and fertilizer and carbon. And so I guess I'm really just asking a naive and desperate question, which is that can quantum computing save us?
Gosh, that's a hard question. So look, I think quantum computing can help for sure. So there's nitrogen fertilizers is one thing that people are looking at. People are looking at the density storage of batteries and how to improve that. But I think if I stand back and I think about it, with the most powerful supercomputers we have now, we can't model things that have more than 20 atoms in it, you know, and nothing is made up really of 20 atoms. It's a very limited thing that they can do. So if we have the understanding of how to simulate things with hundreds of thousands of atoms, which is what I think quantum computing can do, we will have unique ways to change materials and to understand things better. And I think in terms of, you know, my PhD was in solar cells to try and capture light from the sun because I thought that would be useful for the world. There are lots of things I think we'll find if we can have a quantum computer working that will help save the planet. But, you know, who knows what else is going to happen in the meantime. Yeah, there's lots going on.
We might wish that people would use the first quantum computer to figure out how to catalyze the nitrogen reaction and make fertilizer greener, less emissions intensive, but they might just use it to make TikTok faster. So what is there, because I kind of see the potential, especially with renewables coming on, where the energy that we're using to do these things can be green, and the processes themselves, which are running at, you know, about as cold as you can possibly get some of these computers, right, themselves are quite energy intensive. Seems to me that everything might just get constantly even more energy intensive just because it can, but that that might also have environmental consequences. Do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, we do, because it's a constant concern, I think, globally. But, you know, if you make things that are very small, the energy you need to run them, essentially operate them, is much less. So that's one thing. So quantum computers have an advantage of classical in that respect.
Even though they have to be... But then, in enormous super-powered fridges, basically.
So then you have to put them in a controlled environment. So every quantum computing company is looking at how to make those fridges more efficient and to try and raise the temperature of their operation. And so we ourselves are doing that. We've got some very nice results that show higher temperature operation. But I think when technology, you've got to look at everything, yeah? Everything you do is constantly being iterated. Nothing is static. And so, you know, our fridges in 5-10 years' time are going to be very different. The way we operate what we're doing now, I think, is going to be very different. So I think that having that in mind and everybody focusing on those things will, again, pull everyone together.
Thanks, Michelle. That was terrific. Can I take a slightly different angle? And I'm interested to understand a bit more about your mindset. And so when you set off to do something that was impossible to so many, and even now looking forward, where there's still things that seem impossible to so many, you have such conviction and such confidence. And I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the mindset that you need to be able to approach something like this with conviction and with confidence.
Yeah, look, it's a good question. So I think when we started the whole project back in 99, 2000, there was a sense of a theoretical construct, which I loved. And at that time, you know, I was trying to make these devices in Cambridge that was very difficult. And so this construct was simple. It was a nice, simple, elegant thing. And I thought, gosh, things tend to work when they're simpler. So the idea was not mine and how to make the actual computer itself. And so then being a practical person, it's literally just looking at what all the things I need to do to make that work. And so at that time, it was a question of mapping it all out, reading about it and trying to figure out what's the risk. And I'm normally a risk-averse person, so... as my husband will laugh at, I worry about every possible consequence of everything and map it all out. And then having mapped it all out, for me, it felt like the risk of doing it was minor. And so having looked at it all, I thought, well, why aren't we not doing it? And then looking at one of the things I find very frustrating about science, and I found that in Cambridge, was a lot of people will follow what everybody else is doing constantly, like sheep. Someone says this, they will go off and do that. And here I found something, this was a super exciting thing that no one was doing, looked at all the risks, and I thought, well, I can't see why it shouldn't work. And so then it was a question of literally constantly mapping and then demonstrating. And I think one of the things I try and do is to keep myself honest, you know. This is the goal I'm setting. Can I reach that goal? And then what's the next goal? And so I think it's just the systematic. I mean, it's just systematic approach. And then never assuming that I know everything, always assuming that there's something that's going to swipe me from the side, so constantly looking at all the possible things that can go wrong, which can drive my team mad because I always say, well, what about? It's really that approach. And then fundamentally just thinking you only have one life, you might as well do something really bloody useful with it. And if this is something that could work and you think it might work and you have the ability to help make it work, then do it.
The other thing you did was move to Australia.
Yeah.
And you say in one of your lectures, everyone asked you why at the time. And you've said amazing things for Australians to listen to about how the give-it-a-go attitude is responsible for some of the success that your team's had.
Yeah.
But there must have been some negatives as well. So what do you think is the key to the benefits and some of the trade-offs that you made when you took that plunge and came all the way to...
Interesting. So I would say the benefits are so massively outweigh any negatives. So for me, it was academic freedom. It was egalitarian approach. It was leadership at a young age, large collaborative teams, and that competitive give-it-a-go attitude, you know, that kind of irreverence. Yeah, but people think, well, why don't we try it? That. I mean, that's just so valuable. You can't buy that, yeah? That's just amazing. So those were all the positives. I actually think another positive is actually being geographically remote. Keeps you away from all the people herd mentality because you're just not surrounded by them all the time. So I think that's another positive. So the negatives possibly are that you are far away. I don't actually see, personally, I don't find that a negative, but I know that it requires a lot of travel because you don't want to be disconnected from the world. So you do have to keep going out and seeing what the rest of the world is doing. I think the cultural view that it can't be done in Australia, that's probably the biggest negative that I face at the moment. So that sense that, you know, we're really good and we get so far and then it just goes overseas, everyone's kind of like just accepts that that's what's going to happen. And I'm like, well, why does it have to happen? There's no reason that has to happen anymore. And in fact, we're in such a majorly good position that it's criminal to let that happen now. So that cult, that, I don't know what that is. I would love to nix it. And it's everywhere. You know, even, I mean, Kathy Foley is a fantastic chief scientist, but every now and again I'll catch her and she'll say, if we do this, we'll have the chance to lead the world. And I'm like, Kathy, we are leading the world. Don't say that. And she's a lovely person. She brings lots of teams together. And she's been in CSIRO for years, but even every now and again, she doesn't quite believe that we do.
It's like the give it a go attitude only goes so far.
Yeah. And it's I'd love to figure out, if anyone can explain to me why that is, I'd love to know why, because I think if we can change that, we are literally sitting on a powerhouse of so many different technologies. And it can. I really think we could be the powerhouse of the Asia-Pacific in all these fields.
Catherine.
Thanks, Michelle. That was excellent. I have a related question, which is a couple of decades ago, you're kind of going against the grain of some of the other scientists you were working with. How do you persuade someone to give you money to do that? And related question, let's say everything's a couple of decades delayed and you're trying to persuade someone to do that now. Do you think you'd be able to, given the current funding environment?
Yeah, so I think when we went a couple of decades ago, it was sufficiently new and it was ambitious. So we didn't start with, I guess, if I was in the UK, I'm just trying to think, going back in time. If I was in the UK and I tried to put this project up in the UK, it was being seen as totally high risk and too far, you know, unknown, too unknown. And so it definitely would not have worked in the UK, whereas it did work in Australia. So I think being more ambitious in Australia on a project of high risk is better, if that makes sense. So rather than do things iteratively here, you can actually be ambitious here. Whereas I think in the UK, it's harder to be ambitious in that way. So your second question.
Whether or not you'd be able to make that case now.
Personally, I don't know how to describe this, but I just have such intrinsic sense that things have to be done that I would just keep plugging away. So I think for younger scientists, quite often they get, you know, knocked back on getting grants and then they feel like, oh, this is a terrible system, and they fall into the trap of thinking it's the system and not them. And I think with those young people, I say, you've got to passionately believe in it. You've got to write something exciting. You've got to keep going. You know, you've got to totally back yourself. And if you do that and you constantly do that, I think opportunities open up for you. But if you hold yourself back in doubt or get caught in the negative spiral, which is what happened in Cambridge, then you end up just limiting what you can achieve.
I think that's a marvellous note to finish on. I mentioned earlier that the Boyer lectures have been running since 1959, and you don't actually need a quantum computer to work out that that means they're 64 years old this year. And I think after what we've all heard tonight, if the Boyer lectures were to pose a question made famous by the Beatles, will you still need me when I'm 64? The answer would be an emphatic yes. And one final time, can I ask you to thank our Boyer lecturer for 2023, Michelle Simmons.
Thank you.
That was Professor Michelle Simmons answering questions from the audience at the TV recording of her first Boyer lecture, The Atomic Revolution. The full series of four lectures is on the ABC Listen app now. I'm Jonathan Webb. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.